All right, we'll move to our second case this morning, Cullen versus American Security Insurance and Wachovia Bank, case number 11-3422. Mr. Zadakis.
May it please the Court, my name is John Sudeikis. I represent Randy Cohen. Mr. Cohen is now the assignee of Martha Schulte's claims. I'm going to rely on my brief for most points and concentrate here on the filed rate doctrine in HOLA. The filed rate doctrine first. It doesn't exist in Illinois. Well, how do we know that? Well, first of all, we have a specific statute repealing it. That statute was never reenacted by the legislature. We also have a lot of circumstantial proof it doesn't exist. If it did exist, you would see companies, or you would see the director of insurance probably filing suit against many insurance companies because this is a billion-dollar industry. These suits would go through the Administrative Review Act, they'd go up through the trial courts and appellate courts, and we would have decisions coming down interpreting the filed rate doctrine in Illinois. Well, we don't see that in Illinois, which leads you to believe as well that it doesn't exist.
Well, I think you mean to say it doesn't exist in the insurance industry.
Correct, Your Honor. It does exist in the natural gas industry in other places, but not in the insurance industry. The other circumstantial evidence you see is Illinois is a very price-competitive state. Maybe every third or fourth, depending on which channel you're watching, is an insurance commercial competing on price, which leads you to believe there is no filed rate like there is for natural gas in Illinois. We are very price-competitive here. Which we wonder, where is American Specialty Assurance and its parent Assurant in this competition? You don't see them out there competing for customers based on cost or quality. Instead, they're competing for lenders based on kickbacks. Lenders like Wachovia, they have agreements where they conspire to take advantage of borrowers that are unable to maintain insurance on their property. Borrowers can sue, according to them, because they HOLA preempts it. How far can they go in this argument? They don't seem to put any limits in its brief on how far they can force place. Supposedly, they could force place an insurance policy that's 10,000 times more expensive than a borrower's previous policy and take 99% of that as a kickback. But and there is nothing the borrowers can do.
That would probably violate the disclosure. I mean, everything was disclosed in this mortgage transaction consistent with all regulatory requirements, and what was said in the disclosure is that the premiums plus commissions might total five times what the property owner's costs would be in the market for similar insurance. So your hypothetical of 10,000 times might, in fact, state a claim, but that's not what happened here, and that's not what's pleaded here.
But, Judge Sykes, the contract controls, and that's the mortgage agreement when she signed it. I can't send a letter to borrowers or anybody else after the fact saying, you know what, if you breach that contract, I'm going to take advantage of you. Contract law imposed.
That's not what happened. There were all kinds of disclosures that were signed at the time the contract was signed, and so those documents are interpreted as a whole.
Your Honor, the letters that came say we may increase your insurance and it may cost more. That's what those documents said, those LPI notices.
The mortgage. She signed a disclosure at the time of
closing.
Closing, yeah. Right. And that's interpreted with the mortgage documents.
I'm not sure that it should be, but even if I were to accept
then
that.
What is a closing?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, they shove documents in front of you, tell you sign here, 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 and here.
I've done it a few times. Yeah. All of us have, but that's your point, your opportunity to walk away, right?
Well, I suppose in theory it could be, but what did they disclose here? That it could cost more? That we may be entitled to a commission?
No, it warned that you better get your own insurance, or it's really going to cost a lot more if we have to get it. I don't understand. Maybe you have a reason why, well, I guess Schulte or Barnes, whoever it is, quit paying. Why didn't they get the new renewed policy? And we all need homeowners or whatever you want to call it, to protect the house from fire and that sort of thing. And a bank needs to protect its security. So there must be some reason why your client didn't renew.
I'm not aware of any right now, Your Honor.
Just took a risk?
Well, I don't know.
You complain about the backdating. Well, we all know if something occurs during a gap in insurance, could be something that they didn't, damage or repair, they look at that, or an injury or something, they say, well, we weren't insuring at the time. It's an important ingredient in any lending, in any mortgage, to make sure your security is insured.
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor, but what was disclosed here? At the point of closing, Wachovia knows that it has an agreement with Assurant. It pretty much knows what the price of that insurance would be if they had to force place it on Schilke. It wasn't disclosed, look, Ms. Schilke, we have an agreement in place here with Assurant. It's going to more than double your insurance premiums and provide us with a 40% kickback. We didn't do anything to earn this kickback, but that's what it's going to give us.
But why would anybody not buy insurance instead of that, having that imposed on them?
I don't know, Your Honor, but also you have a good faith obligation then, wouldn't you, as Wachovia, if somebody is breaching your contract, to go out to mitigate your damages?
Didn't they warn them a couple of times that they could have gone and gotten their own if they'd otherwise this is going to be imposed?
I think according to the LPI notices Wachovia sent, that may be the case. But even if that were the case, Your Honor, contract law does not allow them to take advantage of Ms. Schilke. This isn't a case where they're saying, oh, we went out into the market, we tried to get whatever insurance we could for you, and this is the best we could do.
Well, they didn't say that's what they were going to do.
But doesn't contract law impose on us a good faith obligation to do that?
Well, I suppose if you say, well, that contract's just on its face unenforceable.
No, I don't
Contract law ordinarily imposes or recognizes that the party who is the victim of a breach gets quite a bit of latitude in trying to cover. And that's, you may not see Wachovia as a victim here, but your client breached.
I would agree that if she didn't pay, she breached.
Is there any dispute about that?
I don't think there is. But if she breached, then, of course, would they not have a duty to mitigate? Do they not have a duty to act reasonably? Is it reasonable for them to enter into these secret agreements where they basically take advantage of their borrowers and force place insurance policies that benefit them most? Your Honor, how difficult is it for any of us to go out there and buy insurance? You could do it on the internet.
On a property that is not subject to an inspection and where the occupant is in breach of that obligation and may not be terribly committed to preserving the condition of the property. That's a pretty risky, much higher risk, isn't it, than a normal mortgage where the homeowner and borrower is meeting their obligations?
But that's not what the evidence shows. If you look at some of the articles written by Horwitz and what's come out with the Attorney General's filing suit against them, they actually have a lower claim, half of the regular claim policies against forced insurance policies than against regular homeowners insurance policies.
Sir, wait. Who has what?
The forced placed the insureds make half the number of claims on forced placed policies as they do against regular policies, indicating that it's not riskier at all. In fact, it appears to be safer. Now, there may be reasons for that, that Wachovia may not be making claims on its own policies, but that's what the evidence shows. And that was part of the Wall Street Journal article as well, and part of the disclosures that came from the 50 state attorney generals that had filed suit against them.
But isn't that forced place, isn't that at the outset where you, when they get a mortgage, you got to get our insurance? Isn't that what the forced place is?
No. You're allowed to get your own insurance. If you don't, the mortgage agreement says we will go out then and get insurance that is necessary and reasonable to protect our interest in the property.
I'm talking about the forced placed in general.
No. Many mortgage agreements do allow homeowners, borrowers, to go out and get their own insurance.
So
I think that's
what's forced then?
The forced is I fail to get my own insurance or provide proof of insurance to Wachovia. Then they are allowed to go out into the insurance market and force place a policy on you and charge you with the premiums.
Mm-hmm.
But
geez, I don't know. I realize that there are some people just aren't going to do it, but there are people that drive without car insurance, too. Young, I guess, don't get health insurance. You know, there are a lot of people that don't want to buy insurance because it's money they hope they don't have to spend and they hope they don't have to have a risk.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I cannot agree that contract law allows them to take advantage of people in this situation.
Why doesn't the Illinois Collateral Protection Act operate as a complete defense here?
Because the agreement, the act states that it exempts insurance that is procured at the beginning of the credit transaction. This insurance is already in place with Assurant. They sign a secret agreement, which they don't disclose to the borrower, that if the borrower doesn't provide proof of insurance, automatically Assurant will insure their property. There actually is no gap because they have a master policy between Wachovia and Assurant that's signed that says if there's any gap in the policy, Assurant will automatically cover it.
But the Act provides a complete defense if the required notices are provided, which I think there's no dispute that they were.
Your Honor, they already had the agreement in place, though. This isn't a case where they're saying, look, we're going to go out into the market and buy insurance for
you. Why does that make any difference in the application of the Act?
Because the Act is meant to protect people who go out in good faith into the insurance market and buy insurance and say, lender, we're not going to hold you liable for negligence or whatever if you couldn't get a good deal for this person. That's not what happens here. The agreement's already in place with Assurant and Wachovia at the time Schilke signs her mortgage agreement. They know exactly what it is. They just won't disclose it to you, the courts, or anybody else. It provides for huge kickbacks, and it's not made in the best faith of the borrower. The only competition you see here is a competition for how much kickbacks an insurance company is going to give back to Wachovia.
I guess I'm still not clear on your argument on this point. Are you conceding that all of the terms of the Collateral Protection Act were met? It's just that its purposes were not?
No. If you look at one of the definitions for the Collateral Protection Act, it says it does not apply for insurance that is procured, I think it says, or some other word, at the beginning like when I go to purchase property at the outset. This insurance was already purchased, if you want to call it purchased, at the outset of the transaction between Schilke and Wachovia. The agreement is already in place. Wachovia is not going out into the market looking for the best deal for Ms. Schilke and failing and then say, look, we fall under the Collateral Protection Act because we acted in good faith to procure insurance for you. The insurance is already procured. There's nothing they have to do at this point. Why should an act absolve them from any liability?
If it's already insured, why would Schilke have to get any?
She probably doesn't.
Well, why?
Well,
but if she did, then whatever is in place is, I assume, displaced.
It is. It's a matter of law, we believe, and they've kept these agreements hidden from everybody. There is an agreement in place between Assurant and Wachovia that all of their borrowers will be covered if they fail to provide for insurance as a matter of law. Wachovia
but
may
that's
not
probably
even
more expensive insurance.
I'm
just
not
in general terms on the market.
It doesn't appear to be that way.
Well, it's open-ended. It's covered no matter what. Usually, and a lot of times, people who mess up their house and do some other things and then go away with no insurance.
If that's the case, then why do I need to provide for these huge kickbacks to Wachovia?
Well, the homeowner can avoid it by just getting their own insurance.
But, Your Honor, then what you're saying is we're allowing them to take advantage of their borrowers. They have a duty to mitigate. They have a duty to act reasonably. This isn't the case where they've gone out and said, look, this is the best we can do for you. Every contract where it's breached, the other side has a duty to mitigate, not to take advantage. This is nothing but taking advantage of these cash-strapped borrowers.
You know, some people talk about gouging and excess profits and all that sort of stuff.
You know, if we go down where HOLA is going to preempt them from all of these things as well, why can't they start imposing other sorts of fees on consumers, saying, well, this impacts our lending? Because that was the defense they made. This impacts our lending. So why don't we put a fee on borrowers who want to get their money back from the bank? We have to give it back from them, but maybe we'll say, you know what, we're going to charge you a 5% transaction fee today if you want your money back, or a 6% or a 7%. That's what we're creating here. We're creating where they look where they're taking advantage of people and they're saying, no, even the courts can't look into this because if you do, you are interfering with us. And that should stop the inquiry from everybody else. Discovery should be allowed as to whether or not these agreements are in place and the amount of the kickbacks that are in place. We're here at the pleading stage speculating as to what the agreements were and what could have happened. We shouldn't be. We weren't allowed discovery on that. We don't allow people...
How much kickback? You keep using that word. How much kickback is involved here?
It's got to be at least 40%.
Of what? The premium?
Yes. And according to some of the other documents you see, because Assurant won't disclose it, but some of the other things you see coming out in the public knowledge from the Wall Street Journal and from the Attorney General's is it could go as high as 80%, these kickbacks. Why, if I'm having an agreement with Assurant, why can't I have an agreement with insurance agents? Well, Covia's probably got hundreds of thousands of mortgages.
Your time has expired.
May I finish my thought, please?
You can finish your thought, but okay. You've already eaten into all of your rebuttal time.
I think all of insurance agents would be fighting over themselves to get their business. They could simply tell insurance agents, go out, find me the best deal for our borrowers, and place an insurance policy for them. That's not what happened. They conspire with one company that provides them with the largest kickbacks in order to take advantage of Ms. Schilke.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Burt?
Mr. Zaidakis is attempting to invite you to become the insurance regulator for the state of Illinois. The legal claims in this case are all based entirely on the argument that Ms. Schilke was charged an unfair or an excessive premium rate because that premium included a commission that was paid to a licensed agent that happened to be an affiliate of Wachovia. But the Illinois Administrative Code requires that the homeowner's rates at issue in this case be filed with the Director of Insurance, and of course those regulations have the force of law. There's been no repeal of the filed rate doctrine in Illinois.
Well, the insurance code doesn't authorize the Department of Insurance to set rates or to approve rates. It has broad regulatory power, but it's not a rate-making agency.
Well, actually, the Illinois Administrative Code, which does have the force of law, requires the filing of rates by
homeowners
insurance.
Right, there's no question about that, but the fact that rates are filed is not enough for the filed rate doctrine to apply.
The
agency has to have some rate-making power.
Well, they have to have the power to review the rates, okay, and that exists in the state of Illinois.
Well, can it reject it?
It can reject it, Your Honor. That's the point. And, in fact, the Anzinger case and the Horowitz case...
In what sense can the department reject a rate?
Well, the rate documents, of course, reflect that there are commission loads in the rates. If the department decided that it would be unfair or somehow deceptive, to use counsel's terms, that the commission load be included in the rate, they could reject the rate.
No, I don't think that's what the regulations provide. They can't reject the rate. They can take other action against the insurer, but they don't have the power to approve or reject rates.
Well, Judge Dow, for example, reviewed this carefully and said, and I'm just quoting him, those provisions encompass and provide that for the DOI authority to disapprove rates and are thus covered by the filed rate doctrine.
That's what he said, but is that consistent with what the regulations provide and with what the department's regulatory authority is? I don't see any regulation that authorizes the approval or disapproval of rates. I see a lot of other regulatory powers and a lot of other things that the department can do to bring insurance companies into line with fair practices, but not rate making or rate approval authority.
Well, actually, I mean, the department is given the authority by the legislature to investigate, order the cessation of, and impose penalties for any the use of any unfair or deceptive act or practice. Now, if a rate
has the director ever used that power to challenge a rate in property insurance?
I'm not aware of a particular instance, Your Honor.
I'm trying to think how insurers would respond to such a challenge with that broad statutory language, which does not specify the power to evaluate rates.
Well, I think the insurer would, as we do often, engage in what are known as interrogatories with the department and the director of insurance. We would find out what the director worried about, and then we would adjust.
Sir, we have a few questions. My concern is push comes to shove. Your interrogatories and negotiations don't work, and the director says lower your rates. The insurance companies would have a pretty strong argument pushing back and saying, you don't have any authority to do that.
Well, I think the answer would be he would have the authority to order the reduction of rates prospectively. He would not have the authority...
Under what language?
Well, I think when the regulations require the filing and give him the authority to review the rates, the rejection of those rates as being unfair is implied within that authority.
Oh, that's an extraordinary argument.
Well,
you sure your clients want to buy into all that for the future if the State Department starts doing that?
I think so, Your Honor, because we don't have any problem with regulators reviewing rates and deciding what is an excessive, unfair.
I think the insurance industry in Illinois would have a very big problem with an implied authority on the part of the Department of Insurance to reject rates in the sense that regulators of a public utility have authority over rate making. That would be an extraordinary development in Illinois law, at least as I understand the regulatory scheme.
Well, Your Honor, we don't view it that way simply because the bottom line is that when the director has the authority to require filing rates, he does, and he has the authority to review those filings, what is he reviewing them for? I mean, he has the authority to then take action if those rates are excessive or unfair.
Transparency, not enforcement authority to actually withhold approval of the rates and deny them effectiveness.
Well, it is certainly true that these rates were filed and they had become public records that everybody understands what the components of the rates are, including the challenged commission in this case. There was a 20% load built into the rates filed with the public, and it wasn't 40%, Your Honor. The actual rate of commission in this case was far below that. It's not in the record, so I shouldn't, but it certainly wasn't 40%.
Is it a public document of which we could take judicial notice?
No, it's not, Your Honor. I mean, I know I can tell you that.
Well, then it's not much help to us.
Yeah, right. Well, the bottom line is that the filed rate doctrine bars a court from awarding relief that's based on the difference between...
I don't think anybody disagrees with that. It's a question of whether it applies here, and you're kind of losing that argument. So you might want to address some of the other possible defenses here. Do any of the plaintiff's claims state a claim?
No, because there's another whole point, which is that there was full disclosure here it was disclosed in writing multiple times that if Wachovia was compelled to buy the insurance, the cost was going to be a great deal more, five times more, but of course it didn't turn out to be five times more, and then also a commission was going to be paid to the Wachovia licensed agency affiliate. And so as a result, Ms. Schilke, failed to show any kind of proximate causation between her claimed omissions about the commission and the purported injury, which, of course, is the payment of the commission. So the claims all fail on that point as well. And, of course, Judge Dow also followed a long line of Illinois Court of Appeal cases that find that without at least nominal damages, which we respectfully suggest are barred by the filed rate doctrine, there can be no private Illinois Consumer Fraud Act injunctive remedy. So, I'll just sum it up, Your Honor. The rates were filed with the director. It's undisputed that they included the challenged commission component. And it is settled law in Illinois that filed rates are deemed per se reasonable. So it wouldn't have been unreasonable for Wachovia to purchase an insurance policy at that rate.
Do you have any cases that support the filed rate doctrine in the context of the insurance industry?
Yes, Your Honor. There's been, it's not in, besides Enzinger and Horowitz in Illinois.
Well, you have the Horowitz was applying Colorado law.
It's true, but it was also explaining how the regulatory analysis, how an Illinois court would conduct a regulatory analysis on a rate.
Right, but the rates were filed in Colorado pursuant to the requirements of the Colorado Regulatory Authority, so it really doesn't have anything to do with what the Department of Insurance in Illinois is empowered to do or not do.
The Anzinger case was an Illinois case involving Illinois-filed rates, and the court essentially applied the filed rate doctrine. I think they call it the exclusive jurisdiction doctrine. But in any case, it was the filed rate doctrine.
That was in the special context of medical malpractice insurance, which has got a whole different regulatory overlay. Isn't that right?
Well, it isn't much different, Your Honor, from the homeowner's insurance where you have to file the rates. I mean, that's what happened there. And in that case, it was a question of whether the director didn't have to approve the rates. He just didn't have to. He just had the power to disapprove them. And we suggest that that is the case here as well.
That was explicit statutory authority.
To disapprove, correct. Correct.
We
here we
here.
Think it's implicit in the regulations. I don't
okay.
think...
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Hockman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rob Hockman on behalf of Wachovia. Judge Hamilton, I think one of your questions addressed the point that the lender needs to have latitude when there is a breach. And this case, in a certain respect, is about what kind of latitude they have. But what part of the reason why the preemption analysis works here is because the answer to that question, if you look at the law of mitigation or you look at the state law of duty of good faith, you're going to get varying answers. And HOLA specifically is designed to prevent exactly that kind of variation in the way lenders are regulated and how they go out and get and pay for lender-placed insurance when their borrowers breach their obligation to do so.
Do you contend that a breach of contract claim would be preempted?
Well, I think Ocwen explains that. I think the breach of contract claim if you look at Ocwen carefully, the 12th claim, it's exhaustive in the way it rolls through. The 12th claim was a claim regarding lender-placed insurance under the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And what Ocwen says says this in no uncertain terms, to the extent that's challenging a cost-plus pricing scheme. So in other words, to the extent you're challenging the pricing of lender-placed insurance, it is preempted. Unless the agreement specifically forbids, doesn't say unless the agreement leaves it open, it says unless the agreement specifically forbids the amount being charged. And it's just like the other example given in Ocwen, that if you have a certain rate of interest, if the loan provides for 4% rate of interest and you turn around, the bank charges 8%, that's a breach of contract. That would survive. So what you do here is you do what Ocwen says. Go and look and see whether the contract, whether the agreement, whether the loan documents forbid what we did. And as I think Judge Sykes...
This sounds like not a preemption analysis, but just a breach of contract analysis.
Well,
I'm not
think,
sure we even need to reach HOLA here.
Well, I think that HOLA is more straightforward, but I think the answer is it's in the
I'm
sort
not
of,
so sure about that.
Yeah, well, it's in the gray area, I think, where HOLA works in this situation is it may be the case under Ocwen that the contract doesn't forbid it, right? And that's our situation. The contract doesn't forbid it. We actually have something beyond that. Not only does the contract not forbid it, but in our case, it permits it. And I think that's why this looks like it fails as a matter of breach of contract. But there might be situations where we don't have documents that are as clear, where a lender didn't send the kind of notices that we sent, where a lender didn't include the kind of disclosures we included, that we would collect commissions, that we might that it would cost more, that it would cost 2 to 5 times more, where the lender didn't operate in that zone.
Just decide this case instead of the hypothetical case that you're
proposing. Well, what I'm saying is I think you can go either way in this case.
Right. I mean, okay. The complaint is deficient insofar as it fails to state a breach of contract claim and the various species of fraud claims, statutory and common law. And the
Collateral Protection Act as well, Your Honor, as a slam dunk here. And actually, Judge Dow said so.
Why isn't the Collateral Protection Act preempted under HOLA?
Yeah, I think the way it would work is you would only reach the Collateral Protection Act if you found that there's a reason to overcome preemption logically. In other words, if state law applies, if you can assert a breach of contract claim, then that breach of contract claim fails under the Collateral Protection Act. If state law doesn't survive, then because of HOLA, his claim fails for that reason. But if he's allowed to assert a duty of good faith or a breach of contract claim of some kind or another, then you have to look at Illinois law. And Illinois law says, no, there is no breach of contract claim. There is no duty of faith claim when you follow these procedures, when you make these disclosures.
Is the record clear that all those required
disclosures? Yes, it's absolutely clear. It's never been challenged, Your Honor. And you can compare. I mean, the model notices are in the statute. And I understand counsel today made a new argument on appeal that somehow this argument late in the game that somehow this insurance has been there all along. But that's just not true, and that's clear on the record. There was a point at which she failed to provide notice. It's agreed.
So there's not some sort of an umbrella policy in case people don't get
That's neither here nor there from the point of view.
Well, I know. Is that what he was referring
to? It's alleged. What's alleged is that there's a policy in place, but that would cover us so that we don't have gaps. But her property was insured by her insurance at the time of closing, and there's no dispute about that. It was only later that she failed to provide the adequate notice. And I just want to add about the Collateral Protection Act, by the way. If you actually read the notice, it goes on to explain that the Act contemplates the notice that they want us to provide, contemplates that the charges would include not only the cost of insurance, but, quote, any other charges we may impose. In other words, the Collateral Protection Act itself anticipates that more than just the cost of insurance would apply. So I think you have a menu of options available for you. You've had plenty of time, and you seem to grasp this. If you have no further questions, I would just conclude by saying HOLA preempts this claim, the fails to state a claim, and to the extent there's any concern about are banks free and clear, the regulation, the Federal Register, actually addresses that directly. The OTS made clear that it was not displacing all kinds of consumer protections from various federal statutes, the Truth in Lending Act, RESPA, the FTC Act, and OTS even said it would fill gaps if necessary. In other words, there was a national regulatory scheme put in place governing this kind of activity, and so long as there's a national regulatory scheme in place, there's no place for state law, and as we discussed, under state law, the claim fails. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Zedekas, your time had expired. You can have 1 minute to quickly sum up a few rebuttal thoughts.
Your Honor, we indict people in this courthouse for kickbacks. What exactly have they done to earn a commission? This agreement is already in place. It is not a commission. It is a straightforward kickback where they're saying, we're going to give you a share of these insurance premiums for no work. This Court of Appeals has to make also decisions for the future. It should not be one where it says anything goes when a party breaches the contract. People and companies respond to incentives. We don't want to put companies or people at the mercy of a company's good intentions. The incentives here are, for Wachovia, how can I profit most? Externally, it might be, what can I legally get away with? It should not be a free good where they use it until their benefit is zero. It may be optimal for Wachovia to force place policies that give them the highest kickbacks. It is certainly not optimal for either Mishulki or society as a whole.
Claire, what you're calling a kickback, everybody else is calling a commission, right?
You're right. That's true, Your Honor. But what have they done for the commission? The agreement is in place with Assurant beforehand. They don't earn it. It's a straight kickback. They don't have insurance agents out there searching the market to find a lower policy.
Okay. Your time has expired. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.